Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Alan Greenspan gave a speech today, something he has done probably thousands of times in his life. Today was a first, though. He said taxes ought to go up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 15th of September. Good to have you with us. What you're about to hear is what we in the radio business call lousy tape. But we're going to run it anyway because it's pretty interesting. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan speaking to the Council of Foreign Relations this morning.
So I'm coming out in favor, for the first time in my memory, of raising taxes.
That last word you couldn't really hear. I don't know if his tie brushed against the microphone or what, but it was Alan Greenspan saying that he is in favor for the first time that he can remember of raising taxes. His thoughts on taxes and the unsustainable deficit are sure to make waves in Washington as Congress tries to figure out what to do about the expiring Bush tax cuts. The same ones, by the way, that Greenspan gave his tacit approval to a decade ago. Raising taxes is one of the most unpopular things that governments do. But Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports Alan Greenspan is not the only one in favor.
Even some conservative economists agree that taxes will need to be raised to deal with the deficit.
Greenspan has a very valid point about the deficit.
Alan Viard is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He says higher taxes wouldn't be his first choice, but they're not all bad.
There would be some harm in the form of disincentives due to higher marginal tax rates. But there would be a significant deficit reduction.
And deficit reduction is the first thing tax hike advocates point to when making their case. But University of Michigan economist Joel Slemrod says there's a lot more to it than that.
Paying down the deficit sounds so abstract. The real issue is that over the long run, the current path will make us less prosperous.
He says that's because lower taxes are fooling us into thinking we have more money to spend than we actually do. What about the argument that lower taxes spur growth? Well, Alan Blinder, a former vice chairman of the Fed, says that makes sense in the short term.
But if you look out to a longer period of time, then you really start worrying about the implications of a large and growing national debt for interest rates. And higher interest rates are part of the formula for slower growth, not more rapid growth.
Still, Blinder says he would hold off on any broad tax hikes until the economy is in better shape. He says at this point, the market isn't questioning the government's ability to pay its debt, and neither is he. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Speaking of economic prosperity, as those guys were, the gap between rich and poor countries is shrinking. A report out today says developing countries are getting richer and industrialized economies are going backward. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
In industrialized countries, investors have watched stock portfolios hemorrhage as emerging economies have been picking up speed. Michael Heise is chief economist with the German insurance company Allianz. Its study looked at global financial wealth in terms of assets like stocks, bank accounts, and insurance policies.
In the emerging market world, there has been some growth of assets even during the crisis.
Why have people in emerging economies done so well? One, they tend to save more than we do. And two, because they are very cautious investors, preferring savings accounts over mutual funds. Altogether, there are now about 500 million people on this planet who can be classified as middle class.
Half of them is located in emerging markets and also developing countries. That wealth is trickling down somewhat into the poorer parts of the world.
The middle class in developing countries might be even larger by other measurements. Tim Smeeting is director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
One part of building wealth that may not be taken into account is the growth of home ownership and home quality in the developing world. People tend to create their own wealth, many of them, by building their own homes.
But progress is relative. The wealth gap has shrunk by two-thirds in the last 10 years. Nonetheless, the average financial wealth in industrialized countries is still 50 times the average in the poorest countries. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
An update now on a story we brought you a couple of weeks ago about how Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are trying to get healthy again by forcing banks to buy back billions of dollars in bad loans. Fannie and Freddie take over those loans to get more cash flowing into the national mortgage market. But the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency told a House subcommittee today the banks seem to have seen the light. They want nothing to do with those loans, so they are not buying them back. The government is trying pretty much anything it can to fix the housing market and to figure out what its role in that market ought to be. American home ownership starts with one basic financial premise, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Marketplace's Elise Roth explains how that happened.
Most mortgages in the U.S. used to be short-term. But when the housing market fell apart in the Great Depression, the government stepped in and 30 years became standard.
30 years would allow the borrower to get through their earning years into retirement and at that point have a fully paid-off mortgage.
Susan Wachter is a real estate professor at Wharton. She says you were supposed to work for 30 years.
Then in the years when earning was no longer possible, the homeowner would be free and clear.
That idea is a little outdated. Nowadays, most people either move or refinance or both before the mortgage is paid off. In most developed countries, 15-year mortgages are standard. Ingrid Gould-Ellen co-directs the Furman Center for Real Estate at NYU. She says 30-year mortgages are safe and predictable, but you pay a lot more interest on them because they last so long. And banks can't afford to have their money tied up for that long.
So we need investors to come in and essentially buy up those mortgages so that banks can then lend more of them.
But because 30 years is such a long time for a loan, investors won't buy the mortgages unless somebody guarantees them, which is what the government has been doing. That's not necessarily bad, but as we all know by now, guaranteeing those mortgages is what got Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into so much trouble, which is why the government is looking to change its role in the housing market. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Started low, ended high on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the primaries last night, we are now basically set for the fall elections. We know who's going to be running against whom, and we know what we're in for. Weeks of campaign ads about the direction of the country, how to bring back jobs, and what to do to fix the economy. Commentator David Frum has some observations about that intersection of politics and economy.
In the first days of the Obama administration, early in 2009, an important decision had to be made. America's banks had racked up $1.5 trillion in losses during the financial crisis, more than their combined total capital. The banks were bankrupt. Some economists argued that the best choice was to follow the example of Sweden in the 1990s. The government should nationalize all the banks, sift through the wreckage, transfer bad assets to a single government-owned bad bank, and then return the cleaned-up banks to private ownership. This option was shot down by Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and economic advisor Larry Summers. They advocated government help to recapitalize the banks without taking them into government ownership. And that is what happened. The private banking sector has now recovered its profitability. It is rebuilding its reserves, and the banks have repaid most of the TARP loans they received from the government. Everybody happy? Far from it. The TARP bailout may have averted a global depression, but it violated just about every idea of fair play. Voters don't care that things might have been worse. You get no marks in politics for beating the spread. Dissatisfied voters seem almost certain to administer severe punishment to the administration in November. Bailouts have become poison for Republicans, too. In Utah, Republican Senator Bob Bennett lost his party's nomination in large part because of his vote for the TARP bailout. You can save the world, but still lose your job. Politicians will learn different lessons from this story. Some will learn, don't stick your neck out for anybody. But there's another possible lesson, too. We're all headed to retirement, sooner or later, whether we like it or not. It's not a bad thing to be able to tell your fellow retirees that you did something big and important during your time on the job.
David Frum spent some time on the job writing speeches for President George W. Bush. He is now the editor of Frum Forum. Next week, Robert Reich is back in the rotation. We would love to hear your thoughts in the meanwhile about the economy or anything else you hear on the broadcast. Send them to us online. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says Contact. As China and India grow economically, and they are, trade between them grows as well. But there are some tensions. There are border disputes. And in particular, India has given sanctuary to some 200,000 Tibetan refugees who moved there decades ago after Chinese crackdowns. A lot of the early refugees live on the margins of the Indian economy, but younger Tibetans there have found some new prosperity. Raymond Thibodeau reports from the outskirts of New Delhi.
In this small processing plant, several workers guide thick egg noodle batter along a conveyor belt into an old-fashioned contraption that looks like a printing press. It turns the yellow batter into noodles.
My father, he knew only how to make noodles.
That's Tibetan entrepreneur Tenzing Wangchuk. He inherited the noodle business from his father, Chodak, who, like the Dalai Lama, fled to India from Tibet in 1959. For Chodak, making noodles was a way to provide a modest living for his family. But for Tenzing, it's different.
With the new generation that's coming, they are educated. They know the laws. Now with computers, internet, you know what's going out in the world. So it is easier to go out and do business.
Tenzing has certainly done that. He's grown the business far beyond his father's dreams. Amdo Noodles now exports nearly 10 tons of noodles a year, mainly to Europe. At 36, Tenzing is part of a confident and growing group of young Tibetan business leaders in India. Sonam Tabgyal is head of the Tibetan Chamber of Commerce.
They're looking at establishing themselves, starting a business which could be inherited by the next generation.
Tobgyal admits these successful entrepreneurs are just a fraction of India's Tibetan community. Most Tibetans remain in the shadowy, informal economy, eking out a living as street merchants, selling handicrafts, carpets, and sweaters. But he says there's been a huge shift into the formal economy, with Tibetan-owned restaurants, travel agencies, factories, and food processing plants. The secret of their success?
We take our spirituality as a big strength. The moment the essence of spiritual is missing, the ethics is gone. We are not in a hurry to get $1 million or $5 million order.
Tobgyal, a devout Buddhist, tells young Tibetan entrepreneurs to treat employees as partners and focus on long-term customer relationships rather than short-term profits. That approach seems to be working. The Tibetan Chamber of Commerce has ballooned in the last 2 years from 10 members to about 200. Tobgyal says the main motivation for many Tibetan business leaders is sharing Tibet's culture with the rest of the world, even China, despite Tibet's troubled history with Beijing.
One of our major targets is to do a business with Chinese. That's the only way the relationship can improve. Because at present with political matter, there's a gap. But it is a business which can bring us together.
Tobgyal hopes as India increases its trade and diplomatic links with China, Tibetans will have made themselves an irreplaceable part of India's economic success story. In Punjab Khor, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Coming up, you remember school lunches?
It has to be good, healthy. You know, like Caesar salads and things that you can get from like a deli.
Yeah, mine weren't like that either. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 46 points today, a little more than 0.4%, closed to 10,572. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 0.5%, wrapped at 2301. The S&P 500 edged up 3 points. A 0.3%, ended at 11.25. Among gainers, shares of MasterCard charged up more than 5% today after the company predicted better earnings ahead. Kraft Foods said it's on track to generate an additional $1 billion in revenue over the next 3 years. Shares bubbled up a nearly 0.3%. Microsoft saw shares boot up 0.3% after releasing the latest version of its web browser. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for August. Produce industry professionals are in the nation's capital for a three-day public policy conference that wraps up tomorrow. What else is brewing? The Great American Beer Festival in Denver, Colorado. 2,200 different beers are expected to be available for tasting. So eat your fruit and veggies first. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I know I said yesterday that I'm not a big fan of anniversary stories, but this is kind of a big week. 2 years ago today, Lehman Brothers went broke, kicking off a crazy couple of months that we are still trying to recover from. Documentary filmmaker Charles Ferguson has a new movie out, Inside Job, it's called, that tries to explain what happened that fall and to figure out who's to blame. So that's where we started when we talked, with me asking whether it's possible to blame individuals for the whole financial crisis or whether the problems on Wall Street were more systemic.
What has happened is that a very substantial fraction of the financial services industry has come to be outside the law. And as it has become increasingly powerful, it has attracted increasingly amoral people. And its behavior has become more and more dangerous to the financial system and to the American economy.
There was also a sort of a trend of not talking about any of this stuff. There's a great moment in the film where one of the few regulators you got on camera was Christine Lagarde, the French finance minister. And you started asking her about Lehman Brothers and when she found out that it was going under.
When were you first told that Lehman, in fact, was going to go bankrupt?
After the fact.
After the fact. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. And what was your reaction when you learned of it?
Holy cow.
Clearly, we're connected financially, but not so much along lines of communication, huh?
I was truly, truly dumbstruck when I learned the extent of the ignorance and disconnectedness of the American regulatory system during the crisis. Paulson and Bernanke were astonishingly ignorant of the consequences of their decision. They did not understand foreign bankruptcy laws. They did not understand that all transactions in London would be halted and that that would cause catastrophic financial results cascading throughout the financial system almost immediately.
I want to play something from the film. It's Alan Sloan. He's a senior editor at Fortune magazine. He's a well-respected financial writer. He tells a little story.
A friend of mine who's involved in a company that has a big financial presence said, well, it's about time you learned about subprime mortgages. So he set up a session with his trading desk and me. And the techie who did all this gets very excited, runs to his computer, pulls up in about 3 seconds this Goldman Sachs issue of securities. It was a complete disaster. Borrowers had borrowed on average 99.3% of the price of the house, which means they have no money in the house.
So for all the blame that Alan puts on Goldman Sachs, and certainly they deserve it, what about Americans looking in the mirror and saying, you know what, a little bit of this is our fault too?
Well, certainly that's true to some extent. There was a bubble. And it was a big bubble, and many people bought houses that they couldn't afford and were careless with regard to the loan documentation that they signed. But over half of people who received subprime mortgages actually would have qualified for a less expensive prime mortgage. They were steered into more expensive subprime mortgages by mortgage brokers who were paid extra money the more expensive the loan they made was. So it was something that was cultivated and in many regards forced upon the American people by the financial services industry.
How come nobody went to jail?
Well, there's a simple, obvious answer, and then there's a deeper, more complicated answer, which I don't fully understand. The simple, obvious answer is that this has become an out-of-control industry, a very, very powerful industry.
What's the more subtle reason that you haven't quite figured out?
Well, for some reason that I truly don't understand, this situation has not generated the level of popular outrage that similar or comparable things have generated at other times in American history. You know, there have been other times in American history, some recent, some long ago, when our leaders, our business leaders, and or our political leaders have done something terribly wrong, and more than once the American people have risen up and said, you know, we simply will not permit this. And that hasn't happened here yet. I think that part of the reason that it hasn't happened might be that people think that finance is too complicated for them to understand, and that the situation is too complicated for them to understand. And indeed, one reason that I made the film is to make it clear that actually they can understand it.
Charles Ferguson, his new film about the financial crisis and the events of fall 2 years ago and how we got there. It's called Inside Job. Mr. Ferguson, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
In between arguing over whether to extend the Bush tax cuts and pass the president's jobs bill, Congress will be doing some actual legislating in the next couple of weeks. They are expected to pass, and the president is expected to sign, the School Nutrition Act. It's a $4.5 billion plan to get healthier food into school cafeterias. It is also the first real increase, that is, beating the rate of inflation, that lunchroom budgets have had in decades. The new money should mean more fruits and vegetables to compete with all the pizza and chicken nuggets you find in school lunchrooms, but what about competing with the pizza parlor right across the street? From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner went back to high school.
In the hot food line at Central High School, just try to order a salt pretzel without getting a few words from Gene Bryant behind the counter.
So, you know that salt ain't good for you. Salt, too. You heard what I told him?
Bryant's anti-sodium crusade fits right into Central High School's campaign to get kids to eat healthier. Bread is now whole grain. French fries are oven-baked. And so every lunchtime, lots of kids sneak off campus to the pizza shop across the street. Here, it's a different scene. Kids order off menus, lounge against the counter. It's just a pizza joint, I know, but compared to the lunchroom, it feels
classy.
That's 16-year-old Asia Mose. I meet her at the end of lunch, lingering at a table with three friends. She's eating pizza and fries.
How much is the pizza and fries here?
Well, actually, the pizza here is $1.50, and these fries I got from a girl over there, and these were only $1.25.
This is the kind of economic decision-making that makes school lunchrooms nervous. Asia is spending $2.75 on her lunch. That's 75 cents more than the cafeteria charges for a whole tray of food.
School meal programs are a business. They have to break even.
Margot Wutan is with the Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington. She says that if lunchrooms serve food that kids don't want to buy, the lunchrooms lose money, money that could be spent on healthier food.
Most school districts and states don't provide additional resources to the meals. All the money comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and what the kids pay.
Under the School Nutrition Act making its way through Congress, the USDA would increase its contribution to the pot by some $4.5 billion over the next 10 years. That's about 6 cents per lunch, enough to pay for an extra banana or half an apple. But the food isn't the only issue. The House version includes an extra $20 million to advise schools on improving menus and redesigning the cafeteria. Kids, it turns out, want a choice of vegetables, and apparently they like round tables more than long ones. In other words, the debate comes down to how much to treat kids like customers. Back at the pizza shop, Asia Mose tells me she would eat healthier food.
It has to be good healthy, you know, like Caesar salads and things that you can get from like a deli, like a little fruit cup.
This from a girl who's consuming a basket of French fries. But the cashier here at the pizza shop does tell me that kids are ordering more salads and more low-fat sandwiches. I head back across the street to Central High School, wondering if a school lunchroom can ever compete with restaurant fare. I put that question to food service manager Kathy Nausner.
You're never going to beat out McDonald's or a corner pizza shop.
But that doesn't stop her from trying. Every time she goes to a restaurant, she's dreaming about how she could do things better. Nausner leads me into the school kitchen. It's a graveyard of forbidden appliances, like the deep fat fryer, and appliances that just don't do the job, like an old vegetable steamer.
And I was down the shore and I had seen this steamer where they did the fresh vegetables inside, and it was only in there for like seconds. You know, here we have to keep things in here for a few minutes to get it, you know, somewhat going. But
and it gets kind of soggy.
Exactly. It just like beats the taste out of everything.
Do you think that a better steamer would actually get kids to eat more lunch food?
That's my personal opinion. If it looks good, they're going to eat it.
Until they do, opening that pizza shop near a high school, still a good investment. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, too, really, about the oil spill in the Gulf. First, Thad Allen said today the well will finally be killed once and for all this weekend, about 5 months after it started. Also, the Interior Department ordered oil companies to plug as many as 3,500 unused wells down on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico today. Sounds like a lot until I tell you that there are about 27,000 old wellheads down there. Crude today, by the way, down 75 cents to about $76 a barrel. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 46 points, a little more than 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 edged up 3 points, about 0.33%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, how people balance their budgets in Britain.
It is preposterous that one-third of UK households are reliant on state handouts for more than half their annual income.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.